Welcome to the Sales Lead Dog Podcast, hosted by CRM technology and sales process expert, Christopher Smith, talking with sales leaders that have separated themselves from the rest of the pack. Listen to find out how the best of the best achieve success with their team and CRM technology. And remember, unless you are the lead dog, the view never changes.
Welcome to Sales Lead Dog. In today's episode, I have joining me Joshua Hall, Managing Director of Kilscher & Company. Let's start over. I completely screwed up the name of your company. Welcome to Sales Lead Dog. Today, I have joining me Joshua Hall. Joshua is the Managing Director of Kilscher North America. Joshua, welcome to Sales Lead Dog.
I appreciate it, Chris. Thank you so much.
Josh, tell me a little bit about Kilscher.
Yeah, so Kilscher is actually, we're a leading technology company in the industrial communication space. So really, if you think of Kilscher, what we do is we help with the industrial communication between devices that maybe don't speak the same language. And Kilscher plays in that area to make sure communication can happen back and forth.
I love having guests on that come from companies like this, that people that make stuff that people probably don't really think about or know about, but is a really vital component to everything we do in the world today.
Yeah.
It's really cool to have you on here.
Well, yeah, I appreciate it. We do like to joke that people don't always realize where Kilscher ends up. Some of our stuff gets embedded in other people's products, but we are in the heart of all what's happening out there in the industrial manufacturing space.
Yeah, that's really cool. Josh, when you look back over your career, what are the three things that have really driven and led to your success?
Yeah, it's probably the first thing is natural curiosity. So what I have found to be successful for me is I kind of geek out over this stuff. So I'm a technology geek in general, and just having that in my DNA means I ask a lot of questions. By asking questions of my colleagues, my customers, I've been able to learn quite a bit as I've gone in my career. And it's really, really helped me progress from, the engineering student who didn't know he wanted to do sales to being in sales and ultimately being a sales leader. The second thing really is something that I think probably the engineering degree helped with, that the nature of being an engineer is I came to sales with the idea that sales was a process. It's a step-by-step thing. We should be able to diagnose it. We should be able to talk about how you progress through a sales pipeline, that it's not just always an innate born skill. And by understanding that, or at least believing that, I was able to learn pretty quickly on the job and advance my skill set, and also then translate that into teaching others. Lastly, the big thing for me, really, as I transitioned kind of to sales leadership, was realizing that there's a number of ways to lead as a sales leader. But one of the big things I've been able to focus on in my career is the coaching side of things. So really bringing that mentality to being a sales leader, and it's not just dictation on this is the way you should do things from behind the desk, but really bringing the coaching aspect to it has really helped me succeed.
Wow, that's terrific. So you're in studying engineering at The Ohio State University.
Go yes.
And you mentioned a little bit ago, like you weren't thinking about, hey, I'm going to have a career in sales. That's why I'm getting my engineering degree. But how did you go from engineer to salesperson?
It's actually a funny story, and it's one I always enjoy telling, mainly because the company is no longer really around, but it brings up nostalgia. So do you remember Circuit City?
Oh, yeah.
By any chance? Okay, so Circuit City was still pretty popular when I was in college, and I went into the local Circuit City near the Ohio State University to buy a laptop. I needed to get a new computer, and I went in and went to buy a laptop, and again, being that self-prescribed technical geek, I knew what I was looking for. I knew what the features were. And the salesperson was talking to me. Apparently, I knew more than the salesperson. I didn't really think too much of it, but I was describing a lot of things to him. And as I was checking out and leaving, the manager actually came over to me and said, hey, we're always looking for salespeople. You seem to know a lot about electronics. Would you, want to work here? And I mentioned, well, I'm a student. He's like, oh, no, it's retail. So there's all kinds of hours. You can work in the evenings. You can work on the weekends. And I stumbled into it that way. Went to work in the audio video department. So these were the guys that were selling the speakers, the receivers, the TVs. And again, things that I just enjoy doing, I like talking about, and happened to find as I was finishing my engineering degree that I had a knack for the sales thing, being able to describe technology, maybe to someone that doesn't quite understand all the ins and outs, but how does it benefit them? Why is it important to them? Why is this one worth the money? Maybe this one's not. I had a natural knack for it and I enjoyed doing it. The passion came through. And then it led to me when I graduated, finding out that there was this thing called sales engineer. And Honeywell was actually that position where you could take that engineering technical degree and apply it towards a sales career.
That's awesome. I imagine thinking, as you were describing your role at Circuit City, you probably learned it a really important lesson, I'm guessing, which is to be inquisitive, to ask questions. Is that right?
Yeah, you had to the people that succeeded there, I was lucky, I think, to have some mentors that I kind of watched and saw how they worked. What you quickly realize is you succeed through recurring business. So Circuit City is straight commission, or was straight commission. So the people that really made a good living, or that could make a living, were the people that had repeat customers. They bought a TV from you, they came back to get a stereo. You build up that rapport by being inquisitive and making sure you're understanding what it is they needed, they wanted, and not just pushing, hey, this is the one that's the highest price. It's Bose, you have to get it. Really understanding what they were trying to do and making a recommendation that fit their needs.
Right.
Those people, you built that rapport, you built that trust level, and they started to come back. So asking a lot of questions, again, asking a lot of questions of my coworkers as well. Why is this one better than that? Listening to when the technicians came in, some of the suppliers would come in to talk about their products so that the sales guys would know what they were. And I was the guy that would bug the rep from Polk Audio or Onkyo, whoever it was, wanting to know the ins and outs of, well, why is this better? Yeah, that's a great stat, but what does that actually mean to the customer?
So how do those lessons learned at Circuit City translate into that first role at Honeywell?
Yeah, the first thing I realized when I got the Honeywell was to take the half, most of the time when a customer came to me at Honeywell, just like when they came to me at Circuit City, they had something they were trying to solve. But as much as I thought our stuff was great, they could care less about what Honeywell's thing did. They didn't come with all the innate knowledge that you sometimes people just assume, well, hey, our stuff's great. You sure don't know about it, right? It's a product. I'm sure you looked on the website. They came and they, I've got a particular problem. I need to measure this, or I need a really high accuracy, high temperature pressure transmitter that will go in this spot in a rugged environment. They were looking for you for the recommendation. And that's where that skill translated, because it was no different than the guy coming in and saying, I know nothing about a stereo system. I want to be able to do this. Here's kind of the price point I'm at. It's got to meet these recommendations, or these bullet points, or sorry, these benefits to me. And you make the recommendation based on the customer. And that directly translated to no different in the industrial space. These customers did not know our products. They knew what they needed.
That's great. What was the hardest thing in those early days as a salesperson for you to learn or cope with?
If I go to Circuit City, was a little bit easier out of the gate because it was you're in person. So when I transitioned to Honeywell, one of the biggest things was it was an inside sales job. So initially, until I got a chance to go outside, I was doing everything via the phone. We didn't have it wasn't Teams or anything at that point. And the hardest thing was you couldn't really read body language. So the habit of a young salesperson was, I think I asked a lot of questions, but if I thought I knew the answer, I jumped right to it. And a little bit of the, I always joked later in my career that the show up and throw up of, hey, oh, I got it. I know exactly what it is you need. Let me tell you all about it. This is the reason it's the greatest thing in the world. And without being able to see someone in person, you didn't necessarily see the reaction. You couldn't build a warmer rapport. So it was really having to temper my want to answer. Even though I've asked the question, my want to show you, hey, here's what we do. I know this is perfect. And really make sure I've gone through that process of discovery with the customer.
Yeah, that is so true because it is a lot easier when you can see their eyes, you can see their facial expressions, you can key off of that. But over the phone, which is a lost art these days because very little business is done over the phone anymore. It's like what we're doing now, Zoom or Teams or whatever, but It's a lost art, I think, to be able to do that type of an interaction with a customer and get them, help guide them through their journey.
It's tough. I mean, the biggest thing is the amount of questions. It always seems like you ask more than. In the back of my head, it was always, man, I'm asking too many questions. But you really had to go through that discovery because I couldn't tell you something and then read your face to see if, I mean, did they quite understand that? Maybe that point didn't hit home. Let me revisit it and make sure they understood what I was trying to say.
Right. So how did those skills of, learning through the inside sales and the cold calling or whatever, just working over the phone, how did that translate into your next role where you're actually out in the field?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing for me was the going out into the field. I would, apart from my colleagues, what I noticed is some of the veteran sales guys, when I transitioned to that field role, they learned really, really well, and they had it. They were prepared. I shouldn't say they were prepared. They were ready to go just from what they knew. The questions they should ask, they didn't always prep. It was just it was knowledge learned from 10 years of doing the job. For me, what really ended up helping me and kind of setting me apart was that's great, but I just can't operate that way. So I would prepare with the questions I wanted to ask in advance. Now we might pivot, we might not get to all those questions, we might go down a different path, but that preparation plan for how I thought the conversation was going to go was a direct translation for that's because that's how I'd approach it on the phone. Is again, I couldn't read people, so I had to prep with the here's what I think I'm going to be asking, here's where I want to direct the customer, here's the information I need to get. And that preparation compared to what I saw some of my colleagues was a distinct difference. For me, I always just chalked it up as that's the only way I know how to operate. I am not a big going in and winging it to a customer. I feel like I'm going to end up wasting their time or we're going to talk about something I wasn't ready to talk about. So as much as I can, I wanted to prep that plan, especially when I was younger because I was still new at this. So.
So let's talk about your transition into leadership. What was behind that decision to say, hey, I think I'm gonna go in a different path with my career?
Yeah, so it was nice enough. Honeywell had a program where that you could go back and get your master's degree, and they would pay for it as long as they saw potential in you to use that, right? So I was an inside salesperson. I was progressing nicely. I was getting, quite frankly, I was getting good reviews. They liked what I was bringing to the table, and so I had approached them with the idea if I'd like to go back and get my MBA to, progress on the business side of things that I'd realized at that point, I'm not going to be on the engineering side. I really like it on the commercial side. At some point, I want to lead an organization, and this is a logical step to get there. So I went back and did my MBA 18-month program when I was there. And towards the end of it, I had a conversation with the gentleman that ran our particular office, was division of Honeywell. And we started talking about what's next steps, and he helped me build, mind map out a career path. And there was a need, there was going to be a want for an inside sales manager to lead that team. It was actually 32 people. So as a young, what would have been that 25, 26-year-old person, to it was a little daunting at the time. That was a mixture of inside sales, customer service, and service RMA group. But for me, it was a matter of I think I've got something I can share. And that was always the big thing. I've learned something. I think I can share this. I can bring some process. I can bring some structure to what we're doing and hopefully improve the team as a whole. And that was the driving point for me. And again, getting the MBA, I think showed the commitment to Honeywell and they're willing to give me a shot. And that's really how I got started. And it was a daunting task. I mean, everyone there was older than me, had been around, more experienced. And again, a large group, but I learned quite a bit. It was baptism by fire in that first role.
Oh, I bet it seems like it always is. Like there's only really one way to learn, and you have got to just jump in the deep
Oh
end and start swimming.
it's my favorite quote actually. If you go back, and I think Ray Bradbury and Kurt Vonnegut both get credit with the quote, but the idea is you got to continually jump off cliffs and develop your wings on the way down. That's the only way I've ever learned. You can really, really learn a subject if you're willing to take that risk.
What was the hardest lesson for you to learn in this new role as a leader?
The fact that just because I knew there was a way to do things didn't mean that I could just say, well, this is the way to do it, and then walk away. I had to learn, first of all, to let everyone have their voice and to develop that buy-in to a point. Obviously, there's sometimes people just won't get on board, and you've got to kind of push. But I had to learn. It's really a difference in my mind between management and leadership. And when I got the position, I thought of it initially as, well, I'm the boss, so they're just going to do what I say we should do. And the most part, they would. But you don't get people to come along for the journey. You don't build that rapport. You don't build a team. You don't build a good culture. So I had stumbling blocks where, luckily, never didn't lose anybody in that first job because of it. But people that had honest conversations with me about, hey, I'd like you to hear my voice, or can we take this as more of a team approach where you've got to make the final decision, but let's collect feedback from the people doing the job. We've got veteran people in customer service. You come from the sales side. Let's get some feedback from these people that have been doing the job for 10 years before you just dictate what we have to do.
Yeah, that's a hard lesson for some people to learn, and but it's a valuable one, that it's you can be a dictator, but eventually your legs are going to get cut out from under you,
Yeah, it only works for so long. It's very, very, very true. Yeah.
What was the best thing, your best memory of that first role as a leader?
My best memory, actually, so there's two that come to mind. First of all, that team was fragmented. So Honeywell bought them shortly before I joined. And again, veteran people that were part of a privately held organization that were now part of a publicly held organization, and there was just a lot of finger pointing, distrust, all kinds of things. And so I didn't know the task that I was being given when I first took over that group, again, across three different really teams. But getting to the point that when I left, they operated as a team. It was really seamless handoffs between the customer service, the inside sales, and even the RMA, the service group, all working together. Really, really took pride in that. I think the happiest memory for me, apart from that, came when I left, and several months after I left, I was at a new organization, and I heard from several people that were still there that were fondly remembering, hey, this is something you put in place. And the new person has been able to pick it up, and it's great because you put this structure in place. We're still using this particular process or documentation or whatever. And when you realize you have that impact, man, that, I thought I was just doing a day-to-day job at the time. And then you look back and realize I actually made people's lives a little bit easier, a little more efficient, helped the business. Again, didn't learn that until months later when people reached out to let me know that. But that's probably the thing I took away most from the time at Honeywell.
That is a great feeling. I remember once I was talking to a new neighbor and found out that he worked at a company where I consulted for a while,
Oh,
and
wow.
that I actually architected and built the core system he used. And he's like, oh, that thing is great, and it just was like, because you never really know. A lot of times you don't get to see the impact that you're having, and it is a very nice feeling to know that you did make some lives better, along the way.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And to your point, sometimes those changes, and I think with the nature of someone that grows, and that has career progression, one of the downsides of it is you a lot of times are onto a new, either it's a new company or a new role, you move into something else before you realize the impact of what you did, a year ago. So
So tell me about your current role now. You're top of the pyramid. Do you have a certain philosophy or framework that you'd like to work from?
yeah, so at Hillshire, it's interesting because we're a rather Hillshire North America in particular. We're a small group. I purposely took over this role, knowing that because I really wanted to kind of get back to being able to really make an impact on a daily basis. So whether structural changes, process changes, whatever, but to have a direct impact. So it's a small group. But the general philosophy I try to bring to the table is coaching. So when it comes to leadership, I bring that approach, the idea that, okay, I don't always know the right thing, but yelling and screaming when I do think I know the right thing, or again, just going back to that dictating the answer is not always the way to go. So try to bring that coaching philosophy. In particular with Hillshire, I've only been here 3 months now. I also brought a lot of that inquisitive. So if you talk to anyone on my team right now, and I'm kind of laughing because they're all in the offices next to me, but they will tell you I've asked why so many times since I got here. Because the question is always, well, why do we do it that way? And it's really not, it's not, because I'm not poking at anything. It's more, let's re-examine because I don't have all the answers. Help understand what we were trying to accomplish. Maybe I have some input, maybe I have some feedback, maybe we can tweak it. So it's been those two. And the coaching style is just something I happened to, I always say, fall into. I was lucky enough that a light bulb moment. And now if you go out and you read any modern leadership books, they will talk about the coaching style. So I've been able to find things to reinforce my thoughts there.
Right.
But the time that I kind of realized this is the philosophy I want to base things around, at the time it was pure happenstance that I realized it.
Tell me about that moment, that light bulb moment.
So I'm lucky enough to have an older son that is actually in college right now playing Division I baseball. And he and I bonded when he was a kid over baseball. It was a great way for us to be around one another, to really get to hang out. So I started coaching youth baseball. He would have been, well, it's been 10 years because now I've coached his little brother. So more than a decade ago. And by natural instinct, if you're coaching a bunch of 8, 9, 10-year-olds,
yeah,
you approach things in a certain way. And that philosophy was, first thing, I always tried to be on their eye level. Kids are shorter than you. I'm 6'3". So kids are shorter. They
yep.
don't like people yelling down at them or even talking with a loud voice, which I can have at times. So I tried to get on their eye level and talk to them. And it was always about explaining what we were trying to accomplish. So the why of things, what good looks like, showing them, show beats tell. So can I get out and actually show them what we should be doing,
yeah,
and reinforcing that, but never coming over the top of, again, you would just never do this with a 9 or 10-year-old of,
yeah,
hey, you're doing it wrong. Just do it my way. You have to get them to understand why you're doing something and why this is the right way to do it, proper way to throw, proper way to hit, run bases, whatever it is. That just came naturally, but you're dealing with kids. That's what you're going to do.
Yep.
And was actually, I was already in management and was struggling with how do I build a sales team, a real team, acted that way. And it was actually my wife that pointed out, well, you're talking about team. You're so good with these kids. Why don't you bring the same philosophy? And I had never occurred to me because I don't want to treat, you don't treat adults like children, but that idea of, hey, let me coach. And really get to the, let me explain the why. Let me show you what we should be doing. At the same token, I'm not the one doing the job anymore. You guys are the ones in the field. So I need your feedback. If something's not working, it doesn't feel right. We got to make a tweak. You know, listening, but again, giving that the why of how we're going to do things and where you can, showing, not telling. So trying to lead from the front. And that was really, it was a light bulb moment, quite frankly. It brought a different approach. It brought a calmness to what I was doing. I had a, you know, North Star that I could always steer at, that this is how I was going to do things, and then allowed me to grow in that career.
I love that. That parallels so much with my philosophy. When we implement technology, people will come to us and say, hey, we need CRM. One of the first questions I ask is why? You know, and if you can't articulate a clear why, it's like, how am I supposed to be able to help you get where you want to go if you yourself don't know and can't
yeah.
communicate it? You know, that we have to know where that stake in the ground is at. Otherwise, how do we know we got there, that we actually achieved success? You know, and so if you don't have a clear vision of why, and that to me translates to so many levels of business. And when we talk about trying to get people to buy into what you're asking them to do, I tell people, you know, you have to give them a why. You know, that it's not only just, hey, this is good for the business, because, okay, great, but what's in it for me? You have to give it to them at a personal level as well. You know, what's their why, to get that buy-in? You have to get everybody rowing in the same direction.
I couldn't agree more. Yeah. It's for whatever reason, I'm one to push as well. So I like the, hey, let's make a decision and go.
Right.
So I'm constantly having to remind myself to go back and work on the why, but it does seem like sometimes it's a lost art. When you see other leaders, like, man, if you just could articulate the why, your entire team would buy into what you're trying to do.
Oh yeah. You have to connect the dots. You can't
yeah.
just assume people understand. Like, you really have to ask, you know, and have them, or if they're able to articulate the why back to you, you're getting the ball rolling in the right direction.
Yeah. Yeah, no, exactly. And a lot of that only happens with communication. That was the other big thing, was going back to the coaching thing. You always had a one-on-one relationship with each of the kids. That's how you got them to open up. That's how you got them to listen. That's how you got them to tell you what they were seeing, what they were doing. Same thing at work, same thing in the business is, you know, like I'm a big fan of one-to-ones with every single person on my team, whether they report to me directly or they report to someone that reports to me. Try to have that conversation on a routine basis. to hear what they had to say.
Is there a difference for you between coaching and mentoring?
Yeah, it's an act. It's a level of action or proaction, I guess I would say, versus reaction. So with coaching, I take it as much more of an active thing. So I am clearly there to show you the way, help you develop those skills, to give feedback when necessary. Sometimes it's not always positive feedback, but let's talk about where the gaps are. With mentoring, I've always treated it a little bit more as a sounding board. So, hey, I've got some experience here. I'd love to impart that wisdom, but really I want to hear what it is you're working on, what you're struggling with. What direction do you want to take this? What do you want to talk about? So it's a little bit more passive for me as a mentor when I've done that, and much more steered by the person that is being mentored. So
what traits do you look for when you're evaluating someone to join your team?
The one universal trait, we're talking about sales, there are several, but if we look at the universal trait from a sales standpoint is, or sorry, from any function is really, it's that inquisitive nature. Are they curious? And if someone comes in and you can really see it, especially now with Teams interviews, I've been doing Teams interviews today, we're adding a new tech support person to our group. And the people that, when I say, do you have any questions, that are curious about what it is we do, how we fit into the world,
right?
That to me is, okay, this is probably somebody we can work with if they've got the rest of the skill set, because they will come in and they will drive themselves to learn. They will get better because they want to get better. They want to know more. Right. So if you can get that curiosity in somebody, whatever the function is, I always feel like, okay, we can work with these guys. You know, I had a boss that told me years ago, and I don't know if it's always the best phrase to use, but he told me years ago, and I've taken it to heart, is you know, you'd rather tame a stallion than push a mule.
Right.
And it's always in the back of my head that, yeah, someone that comes in that's energetic and wants to know all about things and how's it going to work and why does this work, I can help that person. I can work with them all day long. We can find a way to work together, rather than the guy that, you know, the person I've got to poke stay active and to stay on top of things.
Yeah. No.
It's a different mentality. So
totally. As you were talking, you brought up a memory for me I haven't thought about in years, but my first real job interview I went on, one of the first questions I got asked was, do you have any questions? And I'm like, no, I don't. And I could see in his face, I lost the interview right there. And I never forgot that, you know? And so now I stress that with my kids, my nieces and nephews, what questions are you going to ask? You know, like, you better come in there with some good questions, because that's how you stand out. And it's that being inquisitive. You can't just sit there, you know, and be that mule.
Yeah, no, and that I mean, the inquisitive spot to me always, it starts before you ever get into those rooms, and it goes back to the preparation aspect. I mean, so much information is at our fingertips now that, you know, the expectation is, whether it's a customer or whether you're coming in for an interview, you've done some baseline research to try to understand what it is the other person does, what their focus is. Yeah. So you have a couple of questions in your back pocket.
Yeah.
The other part I've found is that if you get a really good in sales, you've heard this over and over again now, but you should be listening more than you're talking.
Yes.
And that's really hard for a lot of salespeople. It's hard for me. I talk a lot. But if you are listening, what I found is a lot of times those questions bubble up naturally. I may come prepped with three or four questions, but I'm going to probably have more in-depth and more important questions based on just listening to what you had to say. Okay, wait a minute. This is something I want to come back to. So yeah, if no one has any questions, it always kind of, it's a little bit of a red flag that jumps out.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. No, that's funny. How do you leverage failure as learning opportunities in your role as a leader?
The first thing I think you have to do is you have to recognize that it was a failure. So I'm a very open, honest, whether it's my failure, whether it's my teammates. Now, you don't rub anybody's nose in it, but you know, depending on the situation, whether it's a team thing that we need to talk about or whether it's an individual, you treat those situations differently, because again, you're not trying to embarrass anybody. But let's talk about, hey, this didn't work. And I can't, it's going to sound like a broken record now, but going back to that coaching philosophy, and especially coming from a baseball world, it was really easy me to talk to kids and say, hey, you realize the best players in the world fail, as a batter, you're going to fail 2 out of 3 times.
Yeah.
So what are you learning from it? That's the whole idea, is these are going to happen. Failures are going to happen, whether it's organizational, teams, individuals. What do we learn from it? As long as we're learning something from it and we're applying that learning to the next time we go out and try at this, then I'm good. And I really mean that. I've talked to my team constantly about any job I've been in. What do we learn from it? What are we going to do differently? And then try to go back and verify with them, okay, did we apply, we said we were going to do this differently. Are we doing it differently now? What have been the results? Do we need to tweak it further? But it goes back to that coaching philosophy, because you're going to fail. And what do you do in that moment, right?
Yeah.
The other thing that it's been a last few years, probably coming out of COVID, and it ties directly into this. I really got into Stoicism, reading the books, Seneca, Marcus Aurelius. There's a great modern writer who's written a bunch of books that kind of summarize these guys. And the big thing in that Stoicism, the idea is what you control in that scenario of failure is one thing. So, right, you have the event, you have the failure, you have a reaction, and ultimately those two things together equal your outcome. The only thing you have control over is your reaction. So in the moment, how did you react? How do you react after the fact? This goes back to the learning. And, yeah. and applying that, reinforcing that with the team, it starts to take the sting out of failure a little bit, where people aren't so, no one needs to hide it. And then we can learn a lot faster as an organization, as a team.
Yeah. I just watched a documentary on Ulysses S. Grant, and they were talking about him, in that what really separated him as a general is when the battle started and everything went to hell, he stayed calm and
yeah.
had this incredible ability to stay calm and look and see what was happening around him and react. And because you can't control what's going to happen, you just have to stay calm and react and figure out what's the path forward so we can get to our ultimate objective.
Very, very true. So often you see in that scenario, and I'm no, by no means perfect at this, but you see in that scenario where we can all diagnose when it goes wrong. And it's especially in a group setting, hey, there was a failure. And then the finger pointing starts. Well, this person didn't get me this. I didn't get this. And none of that matters. We're in the moment. I can't control that happened. We'll deal with that later. This is something we'll learn from. What do we do now? How do we take care of it now? And then we'll come back and do the post-mortem and talk about what changes
need
to be made.
It
is the difference between getting things done, quite frankly, and it just turning into a finger pointing exercise. And
oh yeah, because ultimately we got to get to our objective. We're not going to get there by being stuck in the mud, pointing fingers at each other, saying we're stuck
exactly.
in the mud.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, CRM. Do you love it or do you hate it?
I'm probably one of those weird sales guys that doesn't know any better. Meaning I don't know how to operate without it is what I mean by that.
Yeah,
So I would have come of age when I took over that sales role. Inside sales at Honeywell, and I had technology, right? So everything was in a Rolodex at Circuit City. But when I came to real professional job with a desk, it was Lotus Notes. It wasn't the greatest CRM. It was really, really early stages. But someone said, hey, this is a great way to store your notes, your follow-ups, your action items. It, at that point, it would link up somewhat with your email. And you don't have to scribble everything down on a piece of paper. And I have terrible, horrible handwriting. So to me, this is like, this makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
And it was the tool I was given out of the gate.
Yeah.
So I was an adopter. I never had to make that jump from doing everything in a Covey, notebook or anything else. I came into it that way. So for me, it's always thought, why wouldn't you do this?
Right.
That being said, I've now seen a number of CRMs, and typically it's the launch. It's not so much the product that I totally get why I understand why there are salespeople that just hate it. And they don't hate it. They hate the way it's been implemented.
Yeah.
They hate that it doesn't, they don't see, they don't understand the why, going back to that why. Why are we doing this? How it's actually supposed to help them, support them. So I've spent a lot of time in the last 20 years doing this, trying to get to that why, right? So, and if I can't make the connection, luckily I don't think I've ever gotten to the point that we couldn't at least help them understand a little bit. But yeah, helping them understand the why, for those people that just hate it, it's typically not the CRM. They don't see the value. And that's what you have.
Now, I tell people all the time, it's not about the technology. It's connecting people, process, and data. If we don't do that, it doesn't matter what technology you have. It
Yeah.
really doesn't. It's got to be, you have to have a clear vision. You have to have a clear why. And it's got to resonate on all levels of the people that are using it. It can't just be, hey, this, we need this because we need to have better reporting for management. That's not going to really help you.
Yeah, and that
You
might
know,
be
it's not
part of the
helping the
answer.
salespeople.
Yeah, I mean, it might be part of the answer, but it's not the, hopefully that's not the driving force. And I get in trouble for saying this. I recently had a conversation where the thought maybe from people that haven't been in sales is, well, the CRM is going to, it's going to fix something. So we're going to introduce the CRM and it's going to fix something. You know, we're going to get all this really great data. We're going to be able to forecast. And I constantly go back to the CRM as a tool. It can be, it's a great tool. I really, really, I'm someone that advocates, but it's a tool. It's not the process. And if we're not going to talk about the underlying process and make sure the tool fits the process, you're never going to get what you want out of this. It's going to be at most someone ticking boxes in order to satisfy, to your point, someone in management to be able to get metrics. So.
Now, I couldn't agree more. That's another red flag for me when comes someone says, hey, you know, when I ask why do you need CRM, like, oh, we need it to fix our sales process. Well, I've yet to see any technology fix bad process. You know, it just doesn't happen. The tail can't wag the dog. And as much as hard as you want it to, it's just, you know, it's only going to get you so far. And
Yeah.
so you've got to have good process. You have to understand the buyer's journey and align that. And it's got to be something that truly helps people, that enables people to do more, you know, with less effort, you know, so they're focused on delivering value to the organization, not keen in data, so we have better reports.
Yes, wholeheartedly. Yeah. It's a matter, and you know what fields need to be filled out. That's one of the things. Include what I've found is including the sales group. Maybe not all of them, but certain veterans in the group, leaders that are in the group, whether they have a title or not, about how it can actually help them. Like, here's what we want to do. We want to drive towards this. One of the good things I've seen other organizations do is when they go for implementation. It was part of one where they included the sales group, and they were able to pare down certain fields because you found out, like, well, the sales guy's like, I'm, this is no help to me. I can't ever see an example where I'm going to use this particular field. You know, when you realize that for management, maybe it's not super important. That's really what we want is this other thing. You could really streamline that process and make sure that the sales guys found the value in it, and then you could extract the value out from a, you know, dashboard and a KPI standpoint.
Well, we're coming up on our time here for this episode, Josh. I really appreciate you coming on Sales Lead Dog. If people want to reach out, connect with you, learn more about you or what Hillshire does, what's the best way for them to do that?
Yeah, today it's probably LinkedIn. It's the easiest thing. I've always got, you know, my phone on me. I'm on LinkedIn constantly. So yeah, reach out via LinkedIn. Happy to talk to anybody.
That's awesome. So we will have Josh's LinkedIn information in our show notes. You can get that at ImpellerCRM/SalesLeadDog, where you'll get not only this episode of Sales Lead Dog, but all our episodes of Sales Lead Dog. So be sure to check that out, subscribe so you get all our episodes. Josh, thanks again for coming on Sales Lead Dog and welcome to the Sales Lead Dog Pack.
I appreciate it, Chris. Thank you.
As we end this discussion on Sales Lead Dog, be sure to subscribe to catch all our episodes. On social media, follow us on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Instagram. Watch the videos on YouTube. And you can also find our episodes on our website at ImpellerCRM.com/SalesLeadDog. Sales Lead Dog is supported by Impeller CRM, delivering objectively better CRM for business, guaranteed.